movies and booze on Moncrief.
Brought to you by Lidl's award-winning wine range. Lidl, more for you.
Enjoy alcohol sensibly. Visit drinkaware.ie.
We are joined, as ever, by Esther McCarthy, Leslie Williams and Fionnuala Jones. Good afternoon to you all.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
Yeah. Hi, Sean.
Good stuff. So, Esther, the two movies we're talking about today, give us a little preview of them.
Yeah, The Dig is an unusual one. I wasn't very drawn in it at the outset because it's all set around a huge archaeological discovery on a private estate owned by a woman by the name of Edith Petty. She's a real-life character. And it became known as the Sutton Hoo Dig because it became quite famous. Not least because in one of the huge burial mounds that were on the land for years, and you know, the subject of much speculation locally as to what could be in them for years and years, was an actual ship. Wow. So that ended up in a big museum in Britain. It was hidden actually in the London Underground during the course of World War II, so that the Germans couldn't steal the treasure because it was of huge value in the end. So that's kind of interesting. And what they've done is kind of set that story, but formed a kind of a romantic drama around it, I suppose, with various characters. Lots of stars in this one. Ralph Fiennes, Carey Mulligan playing Edith Pretty. We've got Lily James and Johnny Flynn as well. If you might remember last week when I was having a pop at the Bowie movie that he stars in, I said his career would recover from that, and he has loads of films coming up, and here the very next week you've got one, and he's actually very good in it. So that's The Dig. And then I came across this lovely little New Zealand movie. It's a little indie called Baby Done. Doesn't have a very well-known cast, at least not in this part of the world. And I thought, why is this getting distribution here? And it's all suddenly all over the place. This is to rent and buy on various platforms, by the way. It's a brand new movie. And I thought, there it is. Taika Waititi is executive director on it.
Ah.
So he's, I suppose, spreading a bit of his superpower love to his fellow filmmakers in New Zealand and getting this onto the radar of in this part of the world. And I'm very glad he did. It's very sweet. But it's, you know, it's not a perfect film, but it has a great performance by, she's well known in New Zealand, actually, a woman by the name of Rose Matafeo. And I think she's going to be a star. I think she's going to get cast in lots of stuff based on her performance here.
I would imagine, though, given the situation at the moment, and there's probably a shortage of TV material and film material, there's probably never a better time for a film that might normally only get a viewing in your home country to get a wider distribution, that Netflix and the like will buy this stuff up.
Completely true, you know, and especially for the indies. And, you know, if there's anything good to come out of this, it's that the indies are getting their voices heard, because they would have been drowned out all summer by blockbuster season. We'd be looking at award season movies by now as well. So I like that this is happening, and it's nice to see new voices coming through. This could have gotten distribution anyway. It's quite good. I could have seen it getting a little run in the Lighthouse or somewhere like that, the IFI maybe. But yeah, it's a lovely find. It's kind of simple in a way. It's almost a little bit of a disappointment how straightforward it is in the end. But I have to say, it'd be a lovely COVID watch. It's just kind of leaves you with a smile on your face.
Okay. And Leslie, is it a Shiraz and a Chardonnay we're talking about today?
Exactly. Two classic New World grapes. I'm going to try and open people's minds a little bit more about these grapes and tell them where they should be going and looking for them. Not just these two, but just those grapes in general. We've kind of, they're so familiar. They're the most familiar grapes, I think, to anybody who's sort of drinking wine post-1990. People got a bit bored of them, I think, in some ways, and I think it's time to sort of reevaluate them.
Right, okay. And what part of the so-called New World? Isn't it a bit old-fashioned in wine? They call it the New World. Anyway, but are these New Zealand, Australia? What are we talking about?
Basically, yeah. So in this instance, it's Australia and South Africa. Now, South Africa, of course, technically isn't New World because it wasn't discovered after, you know, Christopher Columbus and so on. But we just sort of, we lump it in there because the styles of the grapes are more, the styles of the wines made in South Africa, and they're more similar. They're warmer countries. They were made in post-colonial time, or in colonial times initially, in the 17th century onwards and so on, as opposed to wines that predate that, like European wines obviously been made since Roman times, and well, 6,000 years BC if you go to Georgia and Armenia and a few places, you know. But yeah, it is an interesting point. I mean, but it's just sort of one of those phrases that sort of stuck, and we still use it, just as a, because the styles in New World wines tend to be richer, they tend to be sunnier places. And this isn't always the case, of course, there's plenty of exceptions, but in general, this is the thing, because you say anything about wine and there's an exception, you know? These are dead cheap wines from Lidl, and they're just, I think they do show varietal characteristic. And that, like, they taste like what a Shiraz should taste, that a Chardonnay should taste like, which isn't necessarily what people think they should taste like.
Ah, interesting. You know what I mean? Interesting point. Looking forward to that then. Of course, Fionnuala Jones is also with us. And as already mentioned, Kerry Mulligan. And there's a bit of a kerfuffle about a review Kerry Mulligan got in a film.
There certainly is. So bear with me on this, because it's a long story that spans last year and this year. She is seen in the new release Promising Young Woman, which I mentioned last week about her bucket list moment with Britney Spears. But there was a review that came out early 2020 from a guy called Dennis Harvey for Variety about Promising Young Woman, because obviously it was supposed to be released last year, 2020. We all know what happened. You don't need me to explain that. Corona ruining everything as per usual. A largely positive review, but in it he questions the casting, particularly with Kerry Mulligan. She plays the lead character, Cassie. And it seems to be drumming up a bit of controversy again because of his comments about the casting. He made a remark saying that he thought maybe executive producer Margot Robbie might be better suited for the role. His quote was that Mulligan seemed a bit of an odd choice, as this admittedly many layered apparent femme fatale. She took issue with it then later on. It came up in an interview with the New York Times, I think, if I remember correctly, at the end again of 2020, where she said it just felt like that he was commenting on her appearance, and that it seemed like he was saying that she wasn't hot enough for the role. And while she didn't take it personally, she felt it wasn't a really great thing to say in 2020. And given the subject matter of the film as well, she didn't think it was great. Variety responded by adding an editor's note at the top of the review, basically apologizing for insensitive language was their word, but they didn't change their view or pull it or whatever. He's responded since and said that it was never his intention, or he never ever meant to imply that Mulligan was not hot enough for the role, saying he's a 60-year-old gay man. He doesn't go around dwelling on the comparative hotness of young actresses. Neither do I. We have something in common there, letting alone writing about that. And he was appalled to be tarred as this misogynist, said it's very alien to his personal beliefs. And it's opened up this kind of debate about reviewers and movies and everything. It's a bit, I don't know how the rest of the story is going to pan out. There seems to be a lot of people who are on kind of the very edge of one side who are calling for his head and calling for him to be sacked and everything else. But I do think Mulligan was right in her interpretation of what he was saying. He's kind of tried to downplay it and say that maybe he wasn't specific enough in his critique of it. I'll let listeners maybe read the review for themselves and maybe make their own mind up. But yeah, lots of drama, lots of drama with that.
Now, yeah, he said she was an odd choice. He also says Cassie, the character she plays, wears her pickup bait gear like bad drag. Even her long blonde hair seems to put on. That might necessarily be a criticism of her, but the clothing decisions made by the film's director and those kind of people, rather than a direct criticism of her.
Exactly, yeah. And in fairness, she has said that she didn't take it as kind of the salt in the wound or as a personal dig, but more as a wider conversation about, as I said, the content of the film and just like why maybe they felt the need to make this comment about her and her appearance. I think where the stickler is the Margot Robbie comparison, I think. And his explanation again was that this is a role that you'd associate with Margot based on the other roles that she's taken. She's more known for this kind of stuff. And he was kind of trying to say that it was more of a compliment to Carrie and that she's such a chameleon and that she was able to do this, but you wouldn't expect it from her. I don't know. I'm hearing the sound of vicious backpedaling as well from his statement to The Guardian. But yeah, as I said, there's definitely a conversation to be had there in terms of maybe diversifying critics and all that kind of jazz. And it's messy. And I think it is one, if anyone's listening to this and they're looking to find out more or whatever, I would encourage people to kind of make up their own mind, read their view and see what you think.
Esther, what do you think of that? Because, I mean, it's completely fair enough to say, you know, Danny DeVito would make a terrible James Bond. But, you know, actors tend to be good at various sorts of roles and maybe not others.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty good roundup of the story from Fionnuala there. But I think you do, you know, the first thing I wanted to do was obviously go and read what he said. And I think it's, you know, I think it's really dodgy territory. And this isn't self-interest on my part or anything like that. I think it's really dodgy to write a disclaimer or an apology at the bottom of someone's critical opinion of the film. I think it denigrates the writer. And it's I don't see the point, you know. And I did read her comments as well in the New York Times, and she said it felt like it was basically saying that I wasn't hot enough to pull off this kind of ruse. And I read the piece again and thought, that's not my take at all. My take is he is saying she's miscast. And I'm on here every other week saying people don't feel right for parts and feel miscast, you know. And I've talked to casting agents about this, and it's such an unusual craft in that when people get it right, you barely notice. But when people get it wrong, like, it can actually drown a whole film. Now, I haven't seen Promising Young Woman yet, so I can't say whether I'll feel she's miscast or not. But I think it's certainly a valid opinion, and to have an apology put on the end of a valid opinion like that, in my view, is very odd.
Yeah. Just to let you know, folks, the European Medicines Agency has approved the AstraZeneca vaccine for everyone over the age of 18. Everyone, they make no mention of under 65s or anything of that nature, I suppose. No doubt, Ciarán will be asking a few questions about that and the hard shoulder later on. Anyway, in the meantime, Leslie, let's have a drink. What are we going to have first?
So, first wine is Chardonnay from Limestone Coast in Austin. It's available from Lidl, and the price is just under €8. So this is not an expensive wine, but I wanted to just think about a little bit this week. Was if we say the word Chardonnay to people, they immediately think of those wines they drank back in 1994 when Jacob's Creek came in, and when all those sort of blousy, vanilla, oaky, sweet, tropical, grapefruit and pineapple flavoured wines came in. And that was really when Ireland started drinking wine. I mean, there would have been a bit of table wine, you know, Barton and Gustier and Blue Nun and stuff like this available. But we didn't really become a wine drinking nation, in my view, until the early mid-90s, when the New World wines came in. And they were initially with Australia. I mean, actually, the first Australian wines that came in, and I remember seeing Rosemount Chardonnay back in around 88, 89, but it was about £7 or £8 a bottle. But then wines came in at about £3-4 a bottle from Australia. And initially, we loved them because they're sweet. They were rich, they were ripe, and they were fruity. But very quickly, we turned against it. It's a bit like those, we don't like looking back on our earliest teenage crushes. We don't want to look back on our those first things that got us into wine. But the Australians, people stopped drinking Chardonnay and then entered New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. And so people started looking for anything but Chardonnay, and ABCs, that became a thing, anything but Chardonnay. And it still lingers on. And you'll still meet people who say, oh, I don't drink Chardonnay, but I do love my champagne and my Chablis, both of which, of course, are, well, Chablis 100% with Chardonnay, and champagne often has Chardonnay in it as well. And if it's Blanc de Blanc, it's 100% Chardonnay usually. What I like about this is that it's really clean and pure. I mean, they're saying in the back of the label that there might be a touch of wood. I'm not getting it. I mean, I'm getting lovely, bright, crisp, clean, apple-y flavors and subtle cleanness and so on. I mean, like, for €8, what are you going to do? You know, you're not... What I wanted us to get is people think that Chardonnay is always going to be oaked, or that it's always going to be overly fruity or sweet. Australians haven't made that style of wine since about 2000. I mean, you'll really struggle to find that wine made in recent years, unless you know, there's one or two high-end ones that will have some oak. But it'll be understated oak. It'll be second-use or third-use oak. It won't be oak chips, which is what we were mostly getting beforehand. So I just like the brightness and the fresh one. Sorry.
Leslie, would you mind saying the name of the wine again? Because unfortunately, your line cut out just as you were saying it.
My apologies. Okay, so it is Chardonnay, Lidl, Limestone Coast from Australia. And the what the name that they've given it to me is a little premium Australian Chardonnay. But really, if you look at the label, you'll just see Chardonnay. You'll see a koala bear sitting in a eucalyptus tree. And you'll see 2019 and selected by the winemaker. So it's part of a new series that they're doing in Niddle where their winemaker has put strong effort into finding wines they felt were suitable and were typical of particular regions. And this is their Australian one.
Right, indeed. Okay, we do have to take a break. Esther, what movie would you like to do first?
Let's do The Dig.
We're going to do The Dig coming up after this.
What are they? Would you hazard a guess?
Burial mounds, I expect. We're standing in someone's graveyard, I reckon. Viking? Maybe older.
Apparently local girls used to lie down on them in the hope of falling pregnant.
Well, I've heard plenty of legends. Is that why you want to dig, Mrs. Pretty? Tales of buried treasure?
My interest in archaeology began like yours when I was scarcely old enough to hold a trowel. My childhood home was built on a Cistercian convent. I helped my father excavate the apse.
That speaks, doesn't it? The past.
There you go. That's The Dig. Tom says he loved the novel. Does it do it justice? So, Esther, we don't expect you to have read the novel as well. That's probably a lot of too much research.
Actually, why bother when the film's coming out anyway?
Yeah.
I'm horrifying people all over the country. First, the good things about this, I think. We're in the heart of awards baiting season, and this is a kind of a gentle and low-key drama that doesn't set out to be Oscar baiting, which is something I really liked about it, actually. It looks beautiful. It's all kind of Suffolk in the 1930s and dappled sunshine and you know, just this beautiful atmospheric look to it on screen, which I really liked. But what I wasn't mad about, and I'm going to put my hands up and say this is a matter of personal taste, I think, is it's a bit too stiff upper lipped. It's a bit too British and a little bit too much suppression going on. And I find that personally, I get a little bit bored with a narrative that focuses too much on that. And I always have done so. You know, I was the crank who didn't like The English Patient when everyone else was falling in love with it. I was the oddball who wasn't really on board with Howard's End when everyone loved it. So I suppose take my reservations to this with a pinch of salt, I guess. The best thing about it for me is Ralph Fiennes. And I know I'm setting myself up for a fall here, but has that man ever turned in a bad performance? Like, he nearly stole In Bruges from Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson, even though he was on the phone for the first half of it. And and like, I didn't know he was, you know, he did so many villainous roles over the years that when he was cast in the Grand Budapest Hotel, the Wes Anderson, I was going, I don't know, can he go full Wes Anderson? I don't know if that's in him. And what we got was one of the best comedic performances of the last 10 years. I think he was just absolutely wonderful in it. So more comedy from Ralph Fiennes, please, is kind of what I'm saying. But here he's the best thing in the film as well. And he has a lovely, there's a lovely rapport between him and Kerry Mulligan, the lovely easiness between the two characters. As I say, she's Edith Pretty, lives in on an estate in Suffolk in 1939, and has these three. You know, this is a historical character, true historic character, by the way. Now, the novel took some liberties with that, but it's based on a true case, I guess. And she was always wondering about these large burial mounds in the garden, the lawn, not the backyard as we know it. But, you know, wondered what was in them. There was speculation locally, but her husband didn't want them kind of disturbed or touched, and he passed away in pretty tragic circumstances, actually, and, you know, left her to raise a young son alone. And I suppose having long felt a hunch that there was something special under the mounds, she decides to bite the bullet, and she tasks this. He's not a qualified archaeologist. But he's extremely experienced digger, by the name of Basil Brown, who's played by Fiennes. I know. Could there be a more English name?
Yeah.
So he's kind of heading the dig, and you heard his lovely strong Suffolk accent there. He's a lovely character, this man. He's a simple man, but Fiennes manages to put flesh on him, of course. But he's kind of a straight talker and a man who he just really likes to get things done, you know. And he's a lovely character because if you passed him in the street in 1939 with his shovel, you go, there's a working class man. And he brings so much nuance to him, and he's a tinker, and he's a, you know, a really just an interesting man. But no nonsense as well. And she kind of loves that, Kerry Mulligan's character, and really leans into him. And they form this very close bond through the course of pretty dramatic events that happen as the dig goes ahead. There's a lot of stuff going on here, maybe a bit too much, because then an hour in as well, the movie changes focus and we get to meet new characters. So that kind of jarred with me a little as well. Not that I object to new characters being introduced late in the movie. I think that can always be a bit of fun, actually. But Lily James, anyway, shows up as Peggy, and she has this kind of passionless, you know, an affectionate but passionless relationship with her husband, I suppose. And there's John E. Flynn, who is, he's Edith's cousin, Rory. A little bit flaky in a nice way. You kind of guy, you know, girls would notice, I suppose. And he's trying to debate whether to sign up to, you know, so World War II obviously looms large in the background of all this, it being 1939. But he's got little experience of digs, but kind of willing to muck in anyway. So as I say, it's all very understated and stiff upper lipped. And I know some people are going to love it. I will say that I didn't feel it quite captured the scope and the scale of the story that it's setting out to tell, though. Because there is a lot of stuff here. There's a lot of really famous historic stuff. But I think the cast hold it together, especially Kerry Mulligan and Ray Fiennes, who have a lovely rapport together. I could have watched them for 2 hours without the need of new characters being introduced, to be honest. It felt a little bit soap opera-y to me then. But a lovely way to spend a Sunday afternoon, a lovely kind of piece of escapism.
And where can you watch it, Esther?
It's on Netflix. It's a Netflix original. And
all right.
You can look out for this come award season, because I think, you know, Kerry Mulligan will at least get one Oscar nomination for her work in the last few months, either in this or in the aforementioned Promising Young Woman, which we were talking about earlier. There's a lot of heat around her at the moment in terms of her performances.
Right. OK. Someone's texted in to say, I just let out a gasp. How could Esther not like The English Patient, but redeemed herself when she spoke wonderfully about Ralph Fiennes? The man is a legend, my favourite actor ever. And a few people have texted in about Fiennes really loving his work over the years, which is true. And is he probably a little bit underrated or unrecognised for his versatility?
Yeah, I think he's just brilliant. And we don't know enough about him in real life. We don't, you know, have set views of him. We just watched those great performances again and again and again. And he did say about 2 or 3 years ago in an interview, though, he was done with playing villains. So I want more comedy, please. But
yeah.
I do, like, I remember where I was sitting. I was sitting in the Adelphi watching Schindler's List, and it was long enough ago that they would have an interval halfway through. And I just remember seeing him the first time on screen as he pointed the rifle out of the window and decided, you know, who am I going to shoot today on that Nazi death camp? And it was just like, oh my God, who is this actor? He is. I don't want to watch him, but I can't look away. And I've just kind of loved him ever since, really, in pretty much anything he's done.
Yeah. Now, Fionnuala, Elliot Page is getting a divorce. Of course, people might know Elliot Page as Ellen Page, but she's not Ellen Page anymore. Do we know why she's getting a divorce?
We don't. And this is a sad story. And I feel like my segment is just going to become this like obituary for celebrity relationships as the pandemic continues. But anyway, I digress. As you said, Elliot Page, probably best known for starring in Juno, most recently in Umbrella Academy on Netflix, filed for divorce from his wife, Emma Portner, after 3 years of marriage. Might catch some people by surprise, because as you said, 3 months ago, Elliot announced that they were transgender and came out as transgender, and his wife at the time expressed her support of him, obviously, as you would if you were married to someone, wrote on social media, "I'm so proud of Elliot Page. Trans, queer and non-binary people are a gift to this world. I ask for patience and privacy and that you join me in the fervent support of trans life every single day." Haven't really heard much from either of them since. I doubt we will. Elliot is quite a private person, so who knows? We'll just have to wait and see. But yeah, sad news.
Right. Okay. But it might or may or may not be connected to the transition.
Potentially. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. You don't know. Right. So sad story there. Okay. We do have one more wine, one more movie to talk about after this. 53106 is our text number that will cost you 30 cents. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. Esther and Leslie and Fionnuala are still with us. Esther was talking about The Dig, which features Ralph Fiennes, was praising Ralph Fiennes, but she did say she didn't like The English Patient. Diana says, "I didn't like The English Patient either." Somebody else texted in to say, "There's a great episode of Seinfeld where Elaine is the only one who hates The English Patient. Very funny." Esther reminded me of this. You didn't know, Esther. An entire episode of Seinfeld is based on you. Ralph Fiennes, seen in Hail Caesar, and he's only really in one scene, stole the whole film. What that twere so simple. Worth watching the film again for that scene. The Constant Garden with Ralph Fiennes, one of the best movies ever. Well, it's turning into a Ralph Fiennes love-in. Fionnuala was telling us as well about there's a controversy over a review that Kerry Mulligan received in one of our films. Some people maintaining that it was a misogynist kind of review. Nora says, "I'm a strong feminist, but I think this controversy is crazy. An example of another internet feeding frenzy, mostly from people who haven't read or have misinterpreted a critique. The still I saw very much validated the opinion expressed in that Kerry Mulligan's wig did make her look like someone in drag," says Cora. Owen says, "You never see an apology after a harsh criticism of a Liam Neeson film because it's a Liam Neeson film." Ah, now come on, Owen. Liam Neeson's middle name is patriarchy. Literally. You can look it up. It's on his birth cert. Right. We'll move on to our second wine of the day. It is our Shiraz. Leslie, tell us about it.
Okay, so this is another one from Lidl, and it's Western Cape, South Africa, Shiraz. Okay, and the picture on this one is of two elephants, a mammy and a baby elephant, which is very cute, walking underneath a tree. So it's there's no producer given. I suspect, sourced this from a cooperative down in South Africa. Western Cape is that big, it's technically a province. It's the province where Cape Town is, so it's the bottom left-hand corner of South Africa. It's a huge region. But it's got lots of little mini climates, and there's lots of unusual microclimate wines coming out of there. But in general, it's just a really good source for fruity, drinkable Shiraz. But what I wanted to say about Shiraz is, most of us think of Shiraz, we think of Barossa, and we think of those big, chocolatey Barossa Shirazes that are all full of condensed, dark fruits, like, say, Dead Arm Shiraz, or anyone who's lucky enough to have tried Grange and that. And this is like Australia's premium grape and so on, and that's what we think of as Shiraz. But, of course, Shiraz is also Syrah, which is the other name, which is what we use if you're in France or in some other parts of the world. It's got these two names. And what kind of happens is, if you want to make a sort of a light, elegant, or not light, but if you want to make a more elegant, aromatic style that's less dense, you call it Syrah. And if you want to make a rich, chocolatey, dark version, you call it Shiraz. But, I mean, it really depends on the producer. It's a bit like Pinot Grigio and Pinot Gris, both of which are the same grape, but not much name you call it. But what I like about this is, it's a kind of a cross between the big Australian style and the more elegant French style. It's got both the fruit of the Australian one, but also some of the elegance and so on. And it's got all these sort of blackberry fruits that I quite like and so on. And again, like, it's 880 or something. So it's really, you know, suitable for the end of the month before your paycheck has come in and so on, and for anybody who's counting the pennies at this time of the year. But Shiraz is just one of those things that, you know, I don't know what you Shiraz
your line's very dodgy there, Leslie. I'm so sorry. I'll risk a question. Matthew says, is Shiraz not in Iran? Is that where the grape is originally from?
No, but that was a theory, but it's long been dismissed. It's native to France.
Right. Okay.
But there is a town called Shiraz in Iran, And it is was at one point the home of the wine industry there. It was seen as a very important wine town. It's still the town of love poetry. So it's Hafez is from there. And every house in Iran has two books, the Quran and Hafez. Only one of them is opened on a regular basis, it's often said. sorry to be... but that's what they say. But Shiraz is this very romantic town, and it was always an important wine town. And so it sort of suited the narrative that Shiraz would have come from there. But no, it's native to France, basically. We're certain of that.
You know? Somebody else wants to know, can you get Lindor sparkling rosé in Ireland? Having lived in New Zealand for a few years, I really enjoyed drinking it. Have been looking for it since I came home.
I haven't come across Lindor that I can think of. I know it, though. I mean, so the name is familiar. Now, you know, the person to ask this, of course, is Jean, who does quite a bit of work with the New Zealand Wine Board. I could possibly be thinking of Lindor chocolates, which is different.
Yeah, you can get them here, definitely. So
yeah, get them there.
So just get the chocolates instead. The hashtag is a tape cassette movies. That's based on the piece that Simon was doing with us about the history of the tape cassette earlier on. Fionnuala, you wouldn't know what a tape cassette is. We might tell you about it later on. did you know that Ralph Fiennes lived in Kilkenny when he was a teenager in the 1970s? Says another texter. So all sorts of people know all sorts of things about Ralph Fiennes. We'll move on to our second movie of the day. It is Baby Done. Here's a clip.
Congratulations.
Tapeworm can cause false positive pregnancy tests.
It's not a tapeworm. It's a baby.
Oh my God! Let's make a list of the wildest things we need to do before the baby comes.
I can't let you climb.
I can do anything pregnant.
Would you join me for the craziest night of your life?
Hey Tim, how are you?
You've gone mental, Zoe. One of us has to get ready.
Aren't you a bit tired of just being so responsible?
Are you just here by yourself?
No, she's meeting me here.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you?
We're supposed to be living our dreams together.
You can't keep acting like nothing's changed.
Are you pregnant?
You're supposed to love me no matter what.
Yeah, well, you're making it impossible.
Right, okay, that's Baby John, as Esther already kind of intimated to us. This is a rather sweet little film.
It's very sweet. It's uneven, I'd say. And if I reference other films from Taika Waititi from his indie career, like The Wonderful Hunt from the Wilder People or What They Do in the Shadows, I would say this doesn't come close. But I'm just saying, I've rarely seen a New Zealand comedy that doesn't make me smile. So more please, first of all. That character you heard there is Zoe, who's played by Rose Matafeo. And yeah, it isn't a tapeworm, Jean. She's really pregnant, much to her surprise. And she, very early on in the film, I think, which nails what the film is about, she says to her boyfriend, who's a lovely performance as well by a man by the name of Matthew Lewis, she says to him very early on, I want to have a baby. I just don't want to turn into a mum. So she has a very, this girl has a very negative attitude towards motherhood. It's not just ambivalence. She thinks like her life's going to be over. It's going to change beyond her control after she has a kid. She even doesn't tell her boyfriend for a couple of months that she's pregnant. She first reveals that to him during a bungee jumping session, which ends very badly for both of them. But it's kind of fun. And she doesn't. Here's the telling one for me. She doesn't tell her best friend because she thinks their friendship will be over. So that's kind of their attitude to, you know, people who get married and settle down, that you're giving something up somehow. And I think it's probably something that's not spoken enough about in our cinema. So that kind of I found interesting. But yeah, the Baby John as well, the reference to it is, her view is marriage, house, baby, done. That's it. Your life's
right.
Over.
Yeah.
So, you know, when she gets pregnant, she's kind of aghast at the prospect of losing her identity, but also kind of excited about this new little person coming into their lives. You first meet Zoe up a tree as well, which is what I liked about her. She's a tree surgeon.
Okay.
She's not a typical, yeah. And there's kind of, it feeds into a lot of the jokes and the comedy in the film as well. But she has these aspirations, Now, you could say she's just been putting them off and that it has nothing to do with her pregnancy. But she has these aspirations that one day she'll travel the world and that she's going to win a national tree climbing climbing competition. So when she gets the test, she's spooked at the idea that life shuddering to a halt and decides that she's going to, you know, escalate all the wish list stuff she's been talking about and actually turn it into a bucket list of things to do before they arrive. That's not a really fully formed idea. As I say, this is slight in places and a little bit patchy, but it's a nice concept that she wants to go off and do all these mad things. Like, she is much more pregnant than she thinks she is as well, but that doesn't, that's not revealed how much until a little way into the film. So she has very little time, I suppose, is what I'm saying, to get her head around this, you know, perceived massive change in her life. And yeah.
How old is she?
It's never pointed out, but she's quite young. I would say late teens, early 20s,
okay.
I would say.
Super young, yeah. Then. Okay, fair enough.
And it's a lovely performance, though, from Rose Matafeo. I hadn't heard of her, but she's actually quite well known in New Zealand.
Apparently she's a stand-up. A few people have texted in to saying, yeah, she does like panel shows in the UK and that kind of stuff. So.
Yeah, and she has a late-night comedy show in New Zealand as well, I think. But she is a natural. Like, she is just... it's just a wonderful performance from her. And you get a little extra treat here as well. If you're a Rachel Howes fan, and, you know, people who are fans of Hunt for the Wilder People will know her as the little boy's foe, the woman, she steals the film, actually. She's just brilliant in it. If you've never seen it, it's wonderful. But she pops up in a scene here as well, a very well-known New Zealand actor who kind of does that little cameo scene-stealing thing in every movie she's in. So you get the added treat of a Rachel Howes performance, a very small one, mind you. This is nice. It is very nice. It is thin. It ultimately throws up fewer surprises than it promises early on. But there are just some lovely comedic moments in there as well. And it becomes quite sweet and touching at the end.
I suppose you can get away with that if you like the characters.
Totally. And yeah, you're rooting for them, you know. And he's a great character as well, Matthew Lewis, is, because he's a guy who's totally excited and embracing and almost mammying her and saying, you can't climb up the tree now, you know. So it's a nice little debunking a few stereotypes there, I suppose.
And where can this one be seen?
This is on all the rental platforms.
Right.
You can buy it or rent it. So you'll find it on all the usual Apple TV. Just Watch will tell you where it is and what it costs.
Yeah, indeed. Your weekly plug for Just Watch.
I haven't got shares in it, I promise you, Sean.
You should have. Mona says, watch White Tiger after Esther's recommendation last week. It was absolutely brilliant. One of the films of the last 12 months, definitely. Thanks, Esther, says Mona. A few of the people saying something similar. On the subject, though, of White Tiger, Fionnuala, is it one of the Jonas Brothers is going to win an Oscar, or might win an Oscar, or somebody with that surname?
So we're talking about Priyanka Chopra, who is married to Nick Jonas and has taken his name. So she's a nice double-barreled name now. She's Priyanka Chopra Jonas, and she's in White Tiger. She plays Pinky. And according to her loving, like, adoring husband, Nick Jonas, has said that she is going to be the first Jonas to win an Oscar. Maybe not necessarily for this. I think he just means in general, potentially. Now, I would say that wouldn't be hard, given the last film that he was in was the Jumanji reboot. So, which I enjoyed, but I can't see the Academy looking at it through the same eyes that I look at it. She's also due to star in the Matrix reboot, which I actually didn't know about, this Matrix 4. So maybe for that as well. Who knows? Yeah, that would be my thoughts as well, Sean.
And what happens in the Matrix 4 that hasn't happened in all the other Matrixes?
I'm sure there's another colour pill to take or something, or they go dance somewhere else. I'm not, who knows, but I'm sure Keanu Reeves will be there. He'll have a great time. Priyanka Chopra will be there, and maybe she'll give in the performance of her life, and she could be the next Indian actor to win. Who knows?
Right.
But this is just a loving couple being very publicly in love with each other, to be honest.
Esther, does Mrs. Jonas deserve an Oscar, did you think?
I don't know if she's in... Award season is harder to suss this year, Sean, because we haven't seen the films on the big screen and they're coming from all different formats and stuff like that. I haven't heard of her in the conversation yet, but I will say I was really impressed with her in White Tiger. I thought she was great, and her characterisation is really good as well, and she makes the most of it because she's a woman who ostensibly, you know, cares about this man who's a servant to her and her husband. But ultimately she doesn't. So she's that kind of, oh, I'm concerned until it's not convenient for me to be anymore. And that's a hard thing to play, I think. And when she does either, you believe her on screen. So she's quite a nuanced character, and she's very good in it. I think she'd get a lot more English language work, but like, she's a superstar in Bollywood anyway. She's one of the highest paid actors in the world, you know, based on her Bollywood experience.
Okay, yeah. So she doesn't need the money anyway. Do you know anything about The Matrix 4?
No, except I'm glad it's coming. I'd be well on board for a more Matrix, although the last one I wasn't mad about, I have to say. But
yeah. People are still texting in. Paul says, The English Patient, singularly the most boring film ever. Plot couldn't be rescued. Sand tense, a man with a headache and more sand, says Paul.
I thought it was just me. There was a scene, I remember a scene in a tent where she was waiting for someone to come back or something, and I was going, jeepers, I feel like I'm waiting for them as well at this stage.
Yeah, well, Paul has left out what is the singularly most memorable element in that film, which is Christian Scott Thomas in a bath. And that's all I remember about the film. And that's all I want to remember about the film. I'll die happy thinking of that. Thanks, of course, to Esther Fanula and Leslie.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Brought to you by Lidl's award-winning wine range. Lidl, more for you.
Enjoy alcohol sensibly. Visit drinkaware.ie.